Hi all, welcome to episode 99 of Ecolation. The ice creams are on me.
Legal note, I take no responsibility for the purchase or distribution of 99s to our listeners.
Last week's show was all about whales and marine protected areas. And we're not about to get out of the water just yet, although some of the rubbish we see on our beaches would definitely give me pause before diving in every day. Because marine litter is a huge problem, and one that clearly inspired a number of students at this year's Young Environmentalist Awards.
Hello, my name is Lewis, and I'm from Errico College. Our project is about marine litter and the effect of plastic in oceans.
8 million tonne a year of plastic getting put in our oceans, that's the equivalent of one dump truck being dumped in the ocean per minute.
If a fish or the sea life can eat the marine litter in the sea and can die from it because they think it's food for them.
Most of it is coming from, you know, everyone's just not recycling or separating their rubbish and it's all just going into the one. It's also coming off the streets and people who aren't cleaning it.
Our school is well bad for pollution, those bottles lying everywhere. And then when this DRS came in, everyone still was throwing the bottles in the bin. So then we got a bin in the school. Now everyone puts their bins in there to help the school.
Now that it's encouraging more people to do the same.
I mean, if we're trying to protect our oceans and prevent plastic waste from coming up in the food chain, then yes, it's very much possible. If we work together, that's why we went over to Greece to spread awareness on what we were trying to do with our bottles and taking them back, building water fountains, introducing reusable bottles, and we also got our school to sign a pledge. We're going to do a pledge to use a reusable bottle and bring their bottles back so we could save for a new water fountain all over the school.
That kind of positive action, not just highlighting the issue, but also realizing that we have power in our homes and our schools to change things, is something we champion. And for today's episode, it's what we want to focus on. Real solutions to serious problems.
Hello, I'm Matthias Eker. I'm the Director of Environmental and Social Affairs at the Ocean Cleanup. We are a non-profit organization, and our mission is to rid the world's oceans of plastic.
Matthias is from Switzerland, a country without a coast. So what drew him to working on our oceans?
I get this question like every time I tell people what I'm doing for work and for life. I mean, it's the unknown, right? In Switzerland, we have lots of mountains, beautiful nature. The one thing we do not have is the ocean. So I was always triggered by, you know, the ocean because we don't have it readily at hand. We cannot just go to the beach. And my parents would take me to Italy on summer vacation. And, you know, I would just jump into that salty water and it actually hurts in your eyes, right? I'm not used to that. As a kid in Switzerland, the lakes don't hurt. The ocean does. And then you dive, you snorkel, and you see all that creatures there in the ocean, which I've never seen before. And that really triggered this interest of, hey, there's this whole world underneath the blue surface. And I was really hooked onto very early to, you know, start to discover the ecosystem, understand it, and also see, okay, hey, what are the threats it's facing? And how can we solve some of the problems our oceans are experiencing these days?
In school, Matthias was similar to a lot of us. Concerned about the problems, but keen to help solve them.
Yeah, so I was about 18, and then I was faced with the decision, okay, what to study? I wanted to go to the university, and essentially I was really into marine biology. But then I was not really ready yet to, you know, leave the country for, let's say, 5 years. So what I did instead of studying marine biology, I studied environmental sciences in Zurich. And as part of this environmental science studies, there was this concept of aquatic ecosystems, but also what we call biogeochemistry, which is essentially studying how things are connected, right? I mean, the most prominent example there is carbon, climate change. So what happens with the carbon? Where does it go? You know, how is it being transformed? And that actually then made me realize, hey, I can study this here in Switzerland. And after I've studied my master's, I can then go abroad because it's 5 years later. I was ready for it. And then I was looking for a PhD that actually enabled me to go out at sea. So I moved to the Netherlands, where I stayed for about 10 years. And I was really fortunate and lucky enough to be able to go on seagoing excursions, expeditions, and really start to, you know, discover the open ocean.
That open ocean is vast. 70% of our planet is covered by our seas, far more than land. And Matthias has experienced everything from the tropics to the icy cold North Seas. But what was the most challenging thing he encountered?
Definitely the snow. I remember like some days working on deck of that boat in the middle of the ocean. It was snowing. It was so cold. And what we were doing is we were studying the deep sea. So, you know, the water you take out on deck and the samples you take out from a few thousand meters below the water surface, it's very cold. It's about 0 to 4 degrees, right? And then on top of that, you have the cold weather. So my hands, I couldn't move my hands anymore. They were frozen. Now, moving into the tropics, you have other issues, which is the heat. So I think that is the biggest difference. Okay, either you're like too hot or too cold. That was a challenge you had to deal with. And also how the sea moves. So let's say when you're in the North Sea or at the Baltic Sea or the North Atlantic also, the waves are a different frequency of the waves. It's very different from when you go into the North Pacific. So between Hawaii and California, that's where we spend a lot of time with the ocean cleanup to clean up the garbage out there. And there you have, let's say, 10, 15 meter waves, but they come very slowly and then they go away again. But if you're in the North Sea, it's very choppy. So you have a couple of meter waves, but they just keep hitting you. So it's a different experience for your body.
Having that broad experience, along with his area of study, meant that Matthias became very aware of patterns and connections.
Well, it made me realize everything is connected. Everything we do is connected, from the bacteria in the ocean to us humans breathing air on land. We all connected, right? And that really was an eye-opener to me, how something as remote as, for example, you know, the open ocean actually directly impacts our daily lives. And when I studied the ocean and the ecosystem, the living beings in the ocean, when I was going on to these expeditions, I saw so much pollution there. And I was spending my days studying the ecosystem and just kind of like ignoring the pollution part, because that was not really part of the research question. And it really bothered me. It's like, okay, why are we not doing anything about this pollution? It's so obvious. It's there. You know, you can see it, you can smell it. And that's when I decided to join the ocean cleanup, to use my knowledge of, you know, how the ocean works and really help the ocean cleanup and succeeding its mission to remove all the plastic pollution from the ocean and, you know, helping marine life to thrive again.
The ocean cleanup's mission is huge, and not only the pollution they find. They're operating within a rapidly changing climate.
I mean, first of all, the speed with which the changes are happening, it's mind-blowing. It's going so fast. I mean, just in my relative short period at sea, let's say over the past 10, 15 years, I've seen it change a lot. And it's difficult for marine ecosystems to keep up with the pace of changes. And yes, there will be winners and losers, both in terms of, you know, countries and people, but also nature. Some species, they will find it easier to thrive in a warmer climate. Some of them will find it very difficult. Like the classical example is the polar bear, right? They need the ice. If the ice is gone, they have an issue. So I see everything is changing. And it's sometimes easy to just cherry pick one out of the other. Just be very pessimistic by picking the worst example. Or say, actually, it's not a problem by picking one of the winners, right? So we need to be very mindful of that there's always winners and losers. But overall, the speed with which we are changing the planet Earth is unprecedented.
And that speed of change meant Matthias felt the urgency. So, when did he first hear about the ocean cleanup?
First heard about it maybe 10 years ago, 11 years ago. So during the early days, when Bojan, the founder and CEO of the ocean cleanup, he was 16 and he gave this TED talk, and I followed it on the sideline. And I was like, hey, that's a great idea. Probably not going to work, but it's nice that at least it tries, right? But then I realized, say, I'm perfect person to bring all that knowledge into, you know, helping him solve this problem. And about 7 years ago, I actively made the decision to leave academia and to go more into applied science, into engineering, problem solving. And what attracted me most was the positive narrative, right? Because as a scientist, we are very often faced with all the problems that can make one very pessimistic. Think of the climate crisis. No, it's very easy to become very pessimistic about it. So is environmental pollution in general. CO2 is just another form of pollution, like so is plastic, right? And so the narrative of, hey, yes, it's a problem, but let's just not finger point at it, but also try to solve it and bring together all these people to work on a problem. So that positivity was really what hooked me onto the ocean cleanup.
Bojan Slat was younger than I am now when he set out on his journey. While on vacation in Greece at 16 years old, he was scuba diving and saw more plastic bags than fish in the sea, which left him thinking, why can't we just clean this up? He started looking into the problem and possible technology solutions to clean up ocean plastic pollution, dedicating a school project to developing his idea further, which makes him a role model for people young and old.
I mean, first of all, working with Bojan, it's amazing. He's such a role model. He's very inspiring. He's very smart, very pragmatic also, and a big visionary thinker. And, you know, it needs people like this, especially young people that think outside the box, that do not accept the fact that they are just not born into this world, they can't do anything about the problems, but they are the ones to bear the consequences. I think a person in their 40s or 50s probably would have never founded the ocean cleanup because it was like Mission Impossible, right? You need this young spirit, this positivism, this optimism that the young generation have to really, you know, go on a venture like the ocean cleanup. And so I think that's really a key strength of the youth is the willingness to change things, the out-of-box thinking, and do not accept the status quo. Like, you know, the older you grow, the more you're just in your day-to-day, and it's just, we've always been doing it like this. You stop questioning some of the aspects we do in our lives. And young people really have this ability to question things. I mean, I keep my own, right? He's 5 years old, and the number one question he always asks is why, why, why? And if you just keep asking that into old age, I think then you can really change the world.
I totally agree. For all that it is hard to answer the questions of why, it's vital we keep trying to find answers. And Boyan Slat, along with other young innovators, continue to inspire the activists of the future, like this group from the Young Environmentalist Awards.
I'm Colin Dowling.
I'm Fran Hannafin. We're from Tralee, County Kerry. Our project is a RC catamaran that cleans up microplastics in the ocean using a eco-friendly system. Water is pumped in using just a normal water pump, and it's mixed with a magnetic fluid, which is made out of iron filings and vegetable oil. This is mixed in a filtration system. They kind of chemically bond the microplastics and the solution. This makes the microplastics magnetic. When the microplastics go in, they meet magnets, so they're attracted to the magnets. Then the water goes through the filter. There's oil-absorbing sponges, which removes all the residue, and the seawater is removed back out into the sea.
We've tested it in Tralee Bay Wetland Centre, and it kind of showed us that there was areas for improvement with it. So, for example, when we turned it on, the nut on our propeller flew off. It kind of showed us that we needed to put a bigger one on that would fit tighter. It worked perfectly other than that, and we filtered microplastics, so yeah. Fionn Ferreira is a young Irish scientist who kind of developed the idea for the ferrofluid, environmentally friendly way of removing the microplastics. And then we just thought, why not put this into like a catamaran that we could put into the ocean that's low cost because it's all 3D printed, except for the PVC pipes. And if we put solar panels on it, it could nearly work all by itself. So that's kind of where we got our inspiration. We only covered a small area for now. And when we do bring it further, we're going to bring it for a scientific test. And then we're going to look at covering more areas, such as kind of a bigger lake or a pond or stuff like that.
That's so impressive. A small solution to the very big problem of microplastics.
So microplastics, they're essentially tiny little pieces of plastics. The great thing about plastic is it's very durable. You can use it a very long time, which makes it a very great material to use. At the same time, it's also a problem, right? Because if it ends up in the environment, it stays there for a very long time. And what happens is it becomes brittle. You have the sun shining on it. You could have like wave action on it. And it starts to break into small pieces. And those pieces we call microplastics. So that's a plastic that's less than 5 millimeters in size. And the problem with microplastic is that, of course, you have the big plastic items like a fishing net. It can lead to entanglement. You know, it can suffocate marine life, or a plastic bag. Sometimes you see whales with their stomachs and bellies full of plastic bags. It's bad. But microplastics, they're so tiny, the smallest creatures in the ocean can start eating them. How marine life works in the ocean is you have the plankton, so the small creatures that are the base of the food web of the whole of the ocean. And if they start eating the plastic, and with the plastic comes a lot of chemicals, stuff that we add to the plastic that's not really healthy. They eat it, they eat the plastic, they eat the chemicals, and like this, they then transfer all that pollution all the way up to the fish that we actually eventually eat.
That's very much the downside of how everything is connected. Microplastics in our bodies. You'd imagine that knowing all of this could leave anyone feeling down, but there is always an upside to knowledge.
The first couple of years I was becoming more and more pessimistic and a little bit depressed, to be honest. For me, it felt like everything is going nuts. Everything is changing to the worse. But then when you actually dive into the data, what we see is actually we are the first generation who can be truly sustainable, who can really make this planet thriving. And I think this is very often forgotten in discussions. Like, actually, we're doing so much already. We're changing it. We have like green technologies. We have the understanding. We have the data. We have the facts. And we can do it. And actually, that shift about a couple of years ago made me very optimistic. I mean, we shouldn't say there are no challenges. The challenges are huge. They are real. And we shouldn't ignore them. but at the same time, we have all the tools. So think about if we would have the same situation as now, but then 30 years ago, we would have known all the problem, how big the problem is, but had not the tools to solve it. That would have been really depressing, right? But now we have the tools and the knowledge. And so that makes me actually very optimistic. And I think that's also key as a science communicator and then as a scientist to also highlight the fact that the oceans, they are resilient. You know, Earth is resilient. It can recover itself. If you look into, for example, overfishing, there are plenty of examples of, you know, where through the right policies, the right solutions, actually fish stocks have recovered, right? We have these marine protected areas. So there is hope. And I want to focus more on the hope while not neglecting the problems, rather than just focus on the problem and say, okay, we're all doomed.
Matthias, Ecolution is fully on board with that. We are all about solutions, and what the ocean cleanup is undertaking in the Pacific Ocean really needs solving. The Great Pacific Garbage Patch.
The Great Pacific Garbage Patch? It's the largest accumulation zone of plastic in the ocean. It's about 3 times the size of France. It's 1.6 million square kilometers. It's really big. If you're in the US, it's twice the size of Texas, the state of Texas. And it's located between about halfway between Hawaii and the US West Coast, so California. And so what happens there is you have this big oceanic currents, and those currents move in such a way that they tend to accumulate floating debris, pieces that float in the ocean in the middle of those currents. So that's why you have these giant vortices that start to accumulate plastic and other float some that is accumulating in the area.
That's insane. But where does all this rubbish come from?
So most of the plastic we find in the ocean comes from land. So think of your single-use plastic bottle, you know, your cutlery, kids' toys, and all those kind of items. However, if you look into the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, what we find is about 80% of the plastic out there comes from fishing activities. And the reason for that is that if you lose a plastic item on land or close to land, you have the tides that bring a lot of the plastic back onto land. So if you just walk on the beach, you see a lot of plastic on that beach. And very often the plastic comes from a nearby river, if you're close to a river. However, if you're out fishing, out in the open ocean, and you lose an item, lose your fishing net or a bucket or other items you need for fishing, you're far away from a coastline. No tides can bring it onto shore. That's when you start accumulating all that fishing gear in the middle of the ocean. And for the Great Pacific Garbage Patch specifically, if you look into which countries it's coming from, it's the big fishing nations in the area. So it's the US, it's China, it's Japan, it's the North Korean Peninsula.
Those nations may be responsible, but there's nothing to be gained by just pointing the finger.
We don't blame anyone, right? What we do instead is we look into, okay, we find all these trawling nets. Why are they there? If you look at it very closely, you can have some clues on whether it was lost or, you know, actually purposefully discarded into the ocean. And using that information, you can go to the fisheries or the governments and tell them, okay, look, this could be one of the main causes for those fish nets to end up in the open ocean. And then you can have a targeted discussion, because fishermen don't want to lose their gear. It's expensive. So they also have an interest in keeping it on board. Like, for example, Korea, but also Norway, there's like these deposit schemes where as a fisherman, you can bring back the fishing gear and you get money back for it. One of the problems is that if you have to pay for your broken gear to be able to, you know, bring back on land, then you incentivize them to actually discard of it in the open ocean. And it's not that you can blame them for doing it. It's very often, you know, they need to make money. And if they lose money, they probably go then the alternative route of tossing it overboard, right? Because those people are not necessarily very rich, right? I mean, they need to make a living. And so they also have to feed their families. So you can't really blame them to make sure that the families have something to eat. So again, this is not to blame anyone, but just look into the data and try to solve the problem at its root further upstream.
And they have an amazing resource that helps them show the data they're collecting, the plastic tracker.
Yeah, so the plastic tracker is essentially a computer model that tells us, okay, how does plastic, once it enters the ocean, where does it go? And so if you go on our website, theoceancleanup.com, there's a plastic tracker, and you can say, okay, if I were to lose a plastic bottle at this location, wherever you are in the world or you want to be virtually, you just say, okay, I lost my plastic bottle, and the plastic tracker will give you a probability, a likelihood, where this bottle will end up eventually. And like this, you know, we run this simulation millions and millions of times, and then we actually get a good understanding of where all the plastic sits in the ocean.
One thing that they also track is how it gets into the ocean in the first place.
So if you want to rid the world's oceans of plastic, you need to do two things, right? You need to close the tap, and you need to remove what's already in the ocean. It's what we call the legacy pollution. So for the legacy pollution, a lot of that is in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, where you go and collect it there. At the tap is mostly rivers. So you have no plastic going into a river, and from there it enters the ocean. And what we do is at the ocean cleanup, we intercept the plastic before it can reach the ocean. We do that by different kind of tools. They're all different versions of an interceptor. Think of just a barrier, a boom, that's essentially placed into a river, and it stops floating objects from being transported into the ocean. And from there, we can then start to collect it and, you know, dispose of it properly or recycle whatever we can recycle. But then if you've ever been to a river or you've been to two rivers, you know that none of them is the same, right? Each river is unique. And so for that, we also need to have different kind of portfolio of solution, different kind of booms, different kind of interceptors. A very good example is a river in Guatemala. I don't know if you've seen it on social media, but there we have this, what we call trash tsunamis. So when it rains, you know, it brings down all the waste, and it's literally a tsunami of plastic that's thrown down that river, which usually has very little water, but when it rains, it flushes down everything. So a lot of water, a lot of trash. And there we have kind of like a fence that's fencing the plastics off. But if you are, for example, in Jamaica, Kingston, you have these gullies that are called small urban drain. There it's very different because then you have kind of like a small boom that fits into the small channels.
And the need for locally specific solutions was something at the forefront of another group's project at the Young Environmentalist Awards.
Hi, I'm Rachel, Mount Mellick Community School, Laois. Our project is about stopping plastic waste from flowing down rivers into larger bodies of water. We do this by using wind energy to power a generator that then powers a air filter that pushes bubbles into a river. This pushes all the plastic waste up to the top of the river, allowing it to flow into sea bins, but it doesn't stop fish and native wildlife to rivers from flowing through. So it doesn't stop their life course or anything like that. Our local river was actually, we do have such a nice walk beside it, but it's kind of an eyesore when you're trying to take a nice walk down the river and you are able to see tons of plastic and everything else that's just in the river. So we wanted a cheap, realistic way to try fix this problem without having to rely on creating jobs, paying people. We wanted something that was easy and could be done with a machine. We're here to show it off on a smaller scale, but we would love to get on a larger scale and get funding for it eventually. That would be our end goal. We have created some prototypes and drawn it onto our river, and we've picked areas, but it's just getting the funding and everything else to put it into the river. I think this could work in any river. It's scalable, it's cheap enough to make, and it's realistic. It works well, it stops the plastic from what we have seen in our experiments, and it doesn't disrupt the river.
The river Rachel and her team worked on was in Laois. But the ocean cleanup is developing technology that allows them to identify the rivers they most need to target.
At the ocean cleanup, we do a lot of research because if you want to solve a problem, you need to understand it in the first place, right? And so what we do is we have developed AI technologies, for example, cameras we put on bridges that look onto the river and it detects plastics. And with this, we can derive, you know, an estimate of how much plastic flows down a specific river. We do that all around the world, and we combine that with our global models, like computer models, that tell us, then, okay, how much plastic is flowing down from different rivers. And what we found is that, you know, about 80% of all the plastic going into the ocean from rivers is just 1,000 rivers. So 1,000 rivers sounds like a lot, but it's actually, if you think of, you know, the problem at hand, how big it is, 1,000 rivers is actually manageable. So and through that science, we can now go very targeted and say, okay, look, those are the top 100 polluting rivers. It probably makes sense to start with the low-hanging fruit and try to develop a solution in these specific rivers.
And their solution is a floating trash gatherer called an interceptor.
So how it works is essentially think of two big open arms that, you know, you put on a river and it channels the debris onto a collection area. And the collection area can be, you know, directly onto land where you have an excavator scooping it out, or kind of like a boat. It looks like a little bit like a spaceship that you place in the middle of a river. It has this blue light, the solar panels, it's fully autonomous. And there you have a conveyor belt that pulls up the plastic, puts it into dumpsters, and you can then take out those dumpsters and empty them on shore.
1,000 rivers seems a lot, but it is doable if the support was there.
The great thing is, you know, we have a scalable solution. What we've shown so far is that if it works in one river, it works in 20 rivers, and it can also work in 1,000 rivers, right? So we have the technology, it's proven, and now it's about scaling it up. So it's essentially about the money. You need the financial support for it, the logistical support to actually go and just copy paste the deployments that we have. And our mission is to be out of business as quickly as possible. It's the worst business you can invent, right? Because you want to go out of business as quickly as possible again. Our aim there is 2040. We want to have removed 90% of the floating plastic in the ocean by 2040.
90% by 2040? That's impressively ambitious. It can seem that when we set a goal for a time in the future, we find it difficult to believe. I think the ocean cleanup can do it. But I'll admit to becoming a little bit sceptical when people in power don't just deny funding for the progress we need, but actively deny that a problem exists.
Yeah, but it's a challenge. My initial reaction is scream at their face, saying, how can you ignore this? But it won't solve any of the problems because they're just ignoring it. I'm a scientist, but also very much involved in global policy discussions. So at the moment, we are negotiating a global plastics treaty that's trying to solve the plastics problem. And then you start to realize that science is just one of the stakeholders for policymakers, right? And you need to realize that for them, science, like for me, science is a fact, right? For them, it's an opinion and they have to balance different opinions. And I mean, of course, that's for me difficult to understand, but I can understand from their point of view because they also feel responsible to also take good care of the other stakeholders and whomever they might be. The good thing about science is it stays a fact whether you believe it or not, right? And you can put a fact out there and you can work towards solution to solve the problem, to understand the problem. And it's irrespective of the political system. And so, for example, at the ocean, what we see is our technology. You know, it's not being politicized because it's not like left or right. Actually, everybody can understand plastic pollution is a problem and can try to solve it, even if your politicians don't really or want to acknowledge the problem. On more regional level, you can still solve it. And even what we see is grassroots. So, you know, just a community coming together and try to solve the problem. And what we can do is we can inform them. We can tell them, you know, how big the problem is, how to tackle it, and, you know, work together. So, I mean, it would be great to have great leaders, right? We all need them. But we can also solve the problem by our own. We don't necessarily need to rely on politicians to solve the problems for us. It would help. And I remain optimistic that a few years from now, there will be changes in our leadership politically all around the world. Again, like those politicians tend to not stay very long in their roles. Maybe 10 years is very long, right? Very often it's shorter than that. And if you look into environmental problems, we can solve them over decades. So it's fine. I think the general upward trend is there. And there will be no bumps in the road. But if you just don't lose sight of the mission, of the vision, of the goal, then you will eventually end up there.
Phew, that's a little reassuring. The YouTube discussion we've done to accompany this episode is full of more reassuring and hopeful stories from the world of our environment. Head over to RTE Kids when you've finished here to watch that. But for now, I'd like to thank Matthias and everyone at the Ocean Cleanup for speaking with us and all the work they do in our rivers and seas. To find out more about what they do, head to theoceancleanup.com. Next week is episode 100 of Ecolution. Wow, I am quite proud of that. And we're celebrating with an amazing guest, broadcaster and all-around legend Liz Bonin. I can confirm it's a good one. This episode is full of positivity alongside the tricky realities, perfectly tailored to Team Ecolution. And we asked Matthias, as we finished up, if there was anything he'd like to say to the young people who will be the innovators of the future.
Yeah, I just want to encourage them that actually, you know, yes, we left them kind of a mess, a big problem to solve, but at the same time, they have all the tools at hand. And just if they stay curious and driven, and also don't, you know, necessarily accept the status quo, if you have a great idea that you want to put into practice, and someone tells you it's impossible, that should trigger you and actually say, oh, wait, if someone tells me it's impossible, that's actually a sign that, you know, I want to disprove them, or it actually usually a sign that no one has really tried it before, so actually this could be a great solution. So just go with it and try it. Nature is so resilient, it's not that all hope is lost. I mean, yes, it's a big problem, but we can still solve it. I think that is really a key message I want to bring along.
Ecolution is produced by Nikki Coughlin with production assistance from Aoife O'Neill, and is presented by me, Evie Kelly.
RTE Kids Podcast.